I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. There's been a lot of news from Latin America this summer. There have been large protests in Brazil, which will be hosting the World Soccer Cup and then the Olympic Games. Peace talks between the Colombian government and the FARC are being negotiated. The head of the notorious and violent Zetas drug cartel in Mexico has been arrested. A ship from Cuba en route to North Korea was stopped in Panama after Soviet-age weapons were found on board. Pope Francis is in Brazil for the Catholic Youth Fest, and several Latin American countries offered asylum to NSA leaker Edward Snowden. Well, today on Radio Times, an update on the news, the developments, and the trends in Latin America, the region's relationship with the United States, and its role on the global stage. We have two guests who have joined us. Shannon K. O'Neill is Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a book called The Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico and the United States and the Road Ahead. She also directs CFR's Independent Task Force on U.S.-Latin American Relations. And Shannon O'Neill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
Also with us is Cynthia Arnson. She's director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, editor of In the Wake of War, Democratization and Internal Armed Conflict, and a forthcoming book she'll be co-editing called Latin American Populism in the 21st Century, joining us from the studios of the Woodrow Wilson Center. And Cynthia Arnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty. Great to be here.
Let me begin with you, Cindy. This is kind of a global question because it's almost impossible to talk about an entire continent. Nonetheless, we're going to do that and break apart some of the countries here. But would it be fair to say that the U.S. has viewed Latin America as a kind of afterthought when it comes to U.S. foreign policy?
Well, it certainly has appeared that way over many decades. But I think what we've seen in the second term of the Obama administration is sort of a wake-up to the fact that the region is important and a place for the U.S. to engage. There have been a number and in rapid sequence of very high-level visits, first by President Obama to Mexico and Costa Rica, where he met with all the Central American presidents, and then Vice President Biden went to Brazil and to Colombia and to Trinidad and Tobago, and then Secretary of State Kerry attended the OAS General Assembly in Guatemala in June. So I think there's a renewal of high-level attention, but I would agree with you that there is certainly greater attention paid to areas like the Middle East, to China, to what's happening, in East Asia, and some of that is very understandable.
Well, let me turn to you, Shannon, because you had an interesting piece in the Daily Beast. The headline is Latin America's secret success story, talking about some of the good news that's coming out of Latin America. Can you spell that out for us?
Sure. Well, usually, as you were saying, we overlook Latin America. It's not part of the headlines. We look elsewhere. But this is a big and increasingly important region. So we look over the last couple decades, and it's been growing fairly quickly, about 4% on average every year. And its share of global GDP, so its importance in the overall global economics, has improved dramatically. It's almost doubled over the last couple decades. It's also incredibly important for the United States, and the trade within the United States to Latin America has grown much more quickly than to other regions of the world. And when we look at what's going back and forth, it's a good mix of things. It's not just commodities, it's other types of goods, manufacturings and the like. And so this is important in the diversification of the relationships between the two countries.
It
moves beyond economics, and we also see here the movement of people. We see the movement of other things between our nations, and the hemisphere itself is becoming more integrated. So it's economics, it's energy, it's people, it's communities, and that is increasingly important as we in the United States, look out at the world, we look at globalization and how we're going to fit into it, where we're going to, put ourselves. Latin America can be a really strong partner for us as we face a lot of global challenges.
Let me just quote what you also wrote in the article. The region still has serious problems. Latin America holds the bloody distinction of being the world's most violent region.
And that is, I would say, today Latin America's biggest challenge. Economically, we've seen stabilization there and, as I mentioned, growth. Politically, we've seen widespread democratization over the last couple of decades, and overall, good steps forward on that side. But where we see the biggest challenge today is in you know, what political scientists would call the rule of law, but really basic safety and the ability for court systems to work to, you know, punish the innocent or punish the guilty and free the innocent. That today is the biggest challenge.
Do you see it that way, Cynthia?
Well, I certainly think that, that crime and violence is a problem for the entire region, and I think there has to be sort of a distinction made between certain countries, certain cities, certain areas of certain cities. I mean, there are real crisis areas. For example, the so-called Northern Triangle of Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, which have the highest rates of homicides, and particularly youth homicides, of anywhere in the world. There are also similar situations in poor areas of major cities like Rio de Janeiro, but there are also some countries that have managed to do quite well: Uruguay, Chile, Costa Rica, Nicaragua. So there's a great deal of variety, but if you look at the public opinion polls that have come out consistently over recent years, published by major polling firms such as Latino Barometro, based in Chile, and the America's Barometer, based at Vanderbilt University, you see overwhelming concern with the levels of crime and violence. And what the America's Barometer also shows is the way that support for democracy and support for democracy as the best system of government goes way down when people are fearful of crime, when they've been a victim of crime. So it is a major challenge, not only for economic development, but also for democratic governance.
Shannon, let me go back to you. And you mentioned Nicaragua. Nicaragua, one of the countries that had offered asylum to Edward Snowden, the other being Bolivia and Venezuela. What do you make of that offer? And obviously, you know, he's still in a Russian airport. But nonetheless, these offers were made.
Sure, the offers were made, though, tellingly, nobody offered to send the presidential plane to go pick him up. So if he could get to these countries, many countries have considered or suggested that they would host Snowden. But there isn't a lot of there if he can't get there, and that is the big question today, as we all know. But I think these positions that these governments have taken, and it's only a certain set of government, it's not the widespread region, but the positions that they have taken reflect more some of this lingering anti-Americanism, and in many ways are these governments playing to domestic politics within their own nations and the ability to strengthen their own rule, especially in Venezuela, where Maduro, the president who's come in after Chavez, is working to consolidate his own political base. Also in Bolivia, where President Morales has often used the United States as a foil. This is one more way to do it, to play to that domestic audience, but so far without any real consequences, because it doesn't look, at least immediately, that Snowden is going anywhere.
Do you think some of that is the legacy of the Cold War that played out across Latin America, Shannon?
You know, some of it is that, but I would say it is more the way U.S. policy, Latin America, often takes a backseat to the more, quote-unquote, pressing problems or more immediate problems. So whether it's on the negative side, it's problems in the Middle East, problems in Iraq and in Afghanistan, Pakistan and the like, or if it's, you know, policymakers and business leaders looking to Asia for the more positive side, Latin America often becomes the second shift there. And so there's a frustration, I do believe, with the sporadic engagement with the United States in Latin America, and it opens up space where the only issues where we work back and forth with some of these countries are things like this, which become more of a problem rather than an ongoing, more positive discussion.
Cynthia, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
Marty, I think there's a more fundamental problem, which is, as Shannon was mentioning, there is a great deal to celebrate in the region: the consolidation of electoral democracies, the economic growth, the historic movement of millions, tens of millions of people into the middle class, some with great precariousness, but still the reductions in levels of poverty have been absolutely historic. But at the same time, there are some really grave problems of democratic governance in the so-called ALBA countries, which have Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, it includes Cuba, where, you know, representative democracy has been under attack, and the notion of what constitutes democracy has been challenged and is dramatically different. And so those countries have, as a general rule, adopted a very different and hostile attitude towards the United States. Not all of it is rooted in the legacy of the Cold War. Some of it is just a strong ideological desire to reduce the power and influence of the United States in the region. The U.S. power is seen as imperial. The United States is seen as a hegemonic power. And part of the ideological orientation of these governments is to confront the United States. And during his lifetime and during his years as president, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela was really the standard bearer, the one who led the way for other countries to stand up and to challenge the United States. He was also the most vociferous champion of Iran's involvement in the region. And so, you know, there is to celebrate, there are extreme, there are really difficult problems. And these are countries where the opposition has very little space in which to maneuver, where opposition media are consistently under pressure. And these are real problem areas that we shouldn't ignore.
And Shannon, do you see Maduro carrying on Hugo Chavez's policies, or is he moderating some, at least when it comes to the United States?
Well, I see him trying to carry on many of Hugo Chavez's policies. The problem he has is twofold. One is that he is not as charismatic or as tied to the various factions within the Chavez movement. He doesn't have the loyalty that Chavez had of various factions, so he has a much harder road to climb politically, the internal politics of Venezuela. But the second issue is that the economics in Venezuela have changed. And over during the run under Chavez and in his 14-plus years in office there, one, he had the benefit of huge amounts of money coming in because of very high oil prices. But he also had a benefit is that he borrowed a lot of money on top of that, often promising oil in the future in return for money today. So basically a credit policy. But what we have today is that oil production in Venezuela has stagnated and many people think have declined. Prices are still high on the international markets, but they've already run up the credit under Chavez. And so Maduro has much less economic room to negotiate there and to provide the patronage and the benefits that Chavez was very successful at doing. And at the same time, many of the problems that happened under Chavez have continued to grow and aggravate. So things like growing crime rates, things like growing inflation that really hits the middle and lower classes the most, those things are starting to come home. And it's very hard to change that economic scenario around without the added money coming into the economy that Chavez was able to bring. So I see it much more difficult for him to, even if he'd like to, which I do believe he wants to continue the Chavez legacy, much more difficult to put forth many of those policies. But one thing he can do is take a very, you know, oppositional or very hostile stance to the United States. And there we have seen there was talk of perhaps an opening up and a thawing of relationships between the United States and Venezuela. But we've seen that return back now, and we see this much stronger stance vis-a-vis the United States, a much more hostile one.
Well, we are talking about news and trends and developments from Latin America, talking with Shannon O'Neill and Cynthia Arnson, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And Cindy, after the break, I do want to talk about events in Colombia. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Rosenfeld Cancer Center at Abington Memorial Hospital supports WHYY and offers the services of both a comprehensive cancer center and a hospital that handles complex medical needs. Oncologists are on call around the clock. An emergency trauma center is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A team of specialized physicians is available if other health issues arise. To learn more, amh.org/cancer. Abington Memorial Hospital, the power to heal.
Next time in Studio 360, with our Battle of the High School Bands in full swing, we'll listen to some of your entries with our Judge Andrew W.K.
You've been accompanying Wachovia Bank Robbers on the air drums.
It's my go-to air instrument, more than guitar and more than vocals.
The music you made in high school. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, 50 years on and there's still no moss on the Rolling Stones. We'll speak with one of their biggest fans about the songs that tell their story. next time on Here and Now from NPR and WVUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. We're talking about current events in Latin America, what they say about the region's quest for progress, its future role on the world stage, and its relationship with the United States. Again, talking with Shannon O'Neill. She's a senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and the Road Ahead. Also with us, Cynthia Arnson, director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, editor of In the Wake of War, Democratization and Internal Armed Conflict, and a forthcoming book she is co-editor of called Latin American Populism in the 21st Century. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Cindy, let's talk about Colombia, and it looks like if negotiations haven't started with the FARC, they are on their way. Is this a sign of true progress?
Well, the peace talks have been underway for some number of months now, and there has been movement, very slow and laborious, but there was agreement on an agrarian accord earlier this year, and they have continued to the next item of the agenda, which involves how the FARC, once it lays down its weapons, would participate in the political system in Colombia. So this was a huge risk for the government of President Santos, but I think that he believed and his advisors believed that the time was really ripe, that the FARC had been dealt such significant blows over a period of years during the Uribe administration, at a time actually when President Santos was a defense minister, major attacks on guerrilla camps, captures of computers, liberation of hostages, massive numbers of desertions, that the FARC militarily was really weakened. And so there were some pre-talks, some feelers sent out to the FARC leadership to see whether this time, after so many failed peace processes, going back really to the early 1980s, you know, there might be the opportunity for peace talks to bear fruit. And I think there's, you know, some degree of cautious optimism, although public opinion in Colombia is a very challenging and vexing problem for the peace talks. The FARC, just in the last couple of days, killed 19 government soldiers in two provinces of Colombia. And, of course, every time the FARC does something like that or takes someone hostage, the very hard public opinion against the guerrilla movement gets only worse. And so that's a significant challenge to the process.
And was this negotiated pretty exclusively inside the country, or were there outside negotiators as well?
Well, the talks are actually taking place in Havana, Cuba. It's a place where the FARC commanders thought that they would be able to have security. But also, I think it's a reaction against the most recent peace process that took place in the late 1990s, early 2000s under the Pastrana administration, in which the FARC was ceded a large territory, a large demilitarized zone within the country. And that there is just zero support or tolerance for that kind of ceding of essentially a protected zone to the guerrillas. So there are a number of countries internationally that are participating as observers, not as mediators formally, but as observers. Norway is there. Cuba is certainly hosting. Venezuela is also playing an important role, as is Chile. And the idea is that they can help break through difficult moments. President Santos just recently met with President Maduro and had very good things to say about the positive role that Venezuela has played in the peace talks and in actually helping bring the FARC to the table and encouraging them to keep negotiating in good faith.
Shannon, let me turn back to you and talk about what's happening in Brazil. I'm actually looking at a piece that was in the New York Times today. Again, headline: prices fuel outrage in Brazil, home of the $30 cheese pizza. The protests that we've seen seem to be a response to the increase in bus fares in São Paulo. What is happening inside of Brazil?
Well, we have seen over now almost the last couple of months a huge surge in protests. and it's been across many, many cities, the big cities, but also smaller cities. And it started, at least in some of the places, because of an increase in bus fares. But I would say underlying that are more fundamental issues. And one of them is, in part, Brazil's success over the last several years. And here you've seen a huge number, tens of millions of Brazilians, move from the lower into the middle classes. But this middle class that they are now part of is a bit tenuous. It's quite fragile, the hold they have on it. Some of it is because of employment and growth, but some of it is because of the expansion of consumer credit. So many of them now have the trappings of the middle class. They have houses and cars and new clothes and electronics and the like, but much of it has been bought on credit. And so there's a real worry here that they'll be able to maintain this lifestyle and they'll be able to provide for themselves but also for their children and something better down the road. So when you see even a small increase in bus fares or you see a small uptick in inflation that hits this class, part of that is the reason behind the protests. The other reason I just like to point out is quickly is that what we've also seen with opening up of Brazil with democratization is an independent press and also laws that have helped, freedom of information laws that have helped uncover a lot of corruption in Brazil. And so while on the front pages of the Brazilian papers you see cases and cases of corruption of private sector individuals, of public officials and the like, you haven't seen the justice system be able to keep up with it and actually convict many of those with these allegations. And so there's a real frustration there where you have sort of a lack of representation, a lack of accountability within the government and more broadly in society to this growing middle class.
And do you think it's also a matter of raised expectations if for many people they had a first step into the middle class?
Well, I think it's a worry that, right, the raised expectations for themselves and their kids, but also that they'll be able to stay in this middle class that they've just been able to join, that they've been striving to join, in part because their joining, a lot of it's been funded by credit. It hasn't been as solid as many would like. So I think there's a real worry there. And any time you start seeing these economic challenges, whether it's bus fares or the like, then all of a sudden you'll see some unrest because people are afraid of what it might mean for them and their family.
Do you want to add to that, Cindy? Then we'll get to some of our callers.
Sure. There's a sense. I mean, again, this is I think a positive change in that the Brazilian democracy has opened up, has allowed for these degrees of participation. There's a great deal of disenchantment with the so-called political class, with political parties, and the ability to sort of articulate the interests of the populace. But I think you know, as much as people have left poverty, tens of millions of people have left poverty in Brazil as a result of the government programs of particularly the conditional cash transfers, the quality of public services remains dismally low. If you have money, you can pay for health, you can pay for education, but the quality of health care and public education, you know, remains low. People are at great risk of falling back into poverty. In fact, the number of vulnerable people identified by the World Bank as those at risk of, you know, one or two paychecks away from slipping back is still very high. So, you know, when people spend hours and hours on the bus getting to and from work, not necessarily in their private cars, but, you know, in public transportation, there is a great deal of frustration. And I think it was not only the increase in bus fares that triggered this, but also, you know, the kind of violent response that we saw at least initially. But the protests have spread to hundreds of Brazilian cities. And this is a real challenge, I think, for President Rousseff and for the political parties in general to find out how to respond to, you know, mass-based demands in Brazilian society.
And that's Cynthia Arnson, director of the Latin American program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, who joins us along with Shannon O'Neill, senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We are talking about some of the news and events and trends coming out of Latin America, of course, home to a number of different countries, we should say. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are not talking about the royal birth today on Radio Time, just so you know. Let me get Rick from Hocassin, Delaware to join us. Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Mari, thanks again for a fascinating show.
Thank you.
I was a 20-year resident of Guatemala and saw a lot over the years, military dictatorships, democracy, a fledgling democracy. And I thought one of the things that's not being mentioned is the voracious drug appetite of the United States. on the import side of this country, and then on the export side, the huge amount of arms that goes down to Mexico, Guatemala, Salvador, Honduras, that goes unchecked. And there's kind of a haughty side to the states. We certify Mexico for drugs each year for their enforcement of it, but we never certify ourselves. And, you know, I one of our closest friends, and it hits every society, this thing, she just graduated, their daughter just graduated from a London School of Economics, was about to work with the Bank of International Development, was in Guatemala City at a restaurant. There was a Zeta drug hit. They came in with M16s, killed seven people, and among them they hit her right between the eyes. Her brother was sitting there, and her father had to sit with her body all night long while the Justice of the Peace was called. And that's the kind of thing that hits these countries. It's not just the poor, it's everybody. And that the U.S. is responsible for part of this northern Central American violence.
Well, Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. A heartbreaking story. And actually, Shannon, if I can go back to you, we haven't really talked about Mexico. We've done whole hours on U.S.-Mexico relations, but Rick raises a number of points, including the drug-gun transfers across the border. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Well, Rick, thank you for your comments and my condolences to that family. It's one of these unfortunate things that's happening across the region, but particularly in Mexico and Central America. We've seen this huge uptick in violence. And there's no doubt that the money that's in the drug trade coming from the United States and many of the guns coming from the United States greatly affect, are part and parcel of this violence. But I would add, as we start thinking through these policies, both in principle, but then also in the terms of real politics and what we can and can't do within this country, I would frame it also this way. When you think about illegal drug markets, the United States illegal drug market is much larger in terms of the amount of money, and there are many more profits here in the United States. That's where the profit margin is between the wholesale and the retail market on our streets, not the transit necessarily through Colombia up through Central America, Mexico to the United States. So there's much more money in drugs here in the United States. There are also many more guns here in the United States than in Mexico and Central America, even with the flow of illegal guns going south. But today in the United States, 20 years ago, you could argue differently, but today in the United States, we have much lower rates of violence associated with the drug trade. So as much as we are part and parcel of the violence that's happening there, there's something else happening in this country that is not just drugs and arms. And that, I would argue, is this rule of law. And so if Mexico, if Guatemala, if other Central American nations, if they can work to establish court systems that work, if they can work to establish professional police forces, then they can take on drug trafficking, but they can also take on other types of violence that really plague these countries and hit the population as much or more than drug trafficking to the north.
And we should add, Cindy, that the head of the Zetas drug cartel was arrested. I don't know whether, I don't know the significance of that, whether someone will take his place and carry on what sometimes looks like a reign of terror in parts of Mexico.
Well, it's certainly good news that this leader of the Zetas, an extremely violent, a graphically violent organization, you know, has been captured. But unfortunately, the history of this, and we've seen it in Colombia, we've seen it in Mexico, is that it leads to sometimes even bloodier competition within the cartel for who is going to take over leadership. It also, you know, creates a lot of competition between and among different drug trafficking organizations. And so there's a constant sort of shifting. And that's not to say that it's not important that this person has been captured and hopefully we'll see the full weight of the justice system, you know, in Mexico. But there, as long as the demand exists, and demand in the United States has diminished significantly, the demand for cocaine in this country, if you look at the statistics provided by the U.S. Office of National Drug Control Policy, demand for cocaine has gone down about 40%. So there have been significant efforts in the United States to do more on this side of the border. But there is just, you know, there are just too many ways in which countries in Latin America have borne the brunt of the violence involved in the production and the processing and the transshipment of these illegal drugs, and they have the sort of dubious distinction of being on the border of the largest drug market in the world, which is precisely why, you know, the OAS and a number of countries in the region have demanded a rethinking of counter-drug policy, the way we approach this, how much we think of it as a public health problem, not only improving justice systems in the region, but also improving the employment opportunities for young people, the social support networks that exist. There's just much more that needs to be done on both sides. But the United States does have, you know, its share of the responsibility for this terrible problem that causes so much death and tragedy in the region.
Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Shannon, let me go back to you. And I'm curious about how the immigration debate in this country is playing out in Mexico, especially the drones, the fences, the military presence along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, this is something the Mexicans are quite worried about, and also feel that it's a bit hypocritical. They see Mexicans coming north, many of them because of the demand for work here. Mexicans come here and they're able to get jobs here. They help fuel the U.S. economy in many regions and many different sectors. And then given all this effort and you know, blood, sweat, and tears that Mexicans put into the U.S. economy, making it much stronger, then they feel often this is almost a slap in the face, the putting up of the walls and the like there. But what is interesting is this time around, when we look at the immigration reform debates versus, say, 10 years ago when President Bush first talked about it with Vicente Fox, who was the new president of Mexico there, or even in 2007, the Mexicans are taking a much more hands-off approach to participating in or even voicing opinions about immigration reform. And in fact, when President Obama was down in Mexico in early May, he met with the new president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, and in the press conference, Peña Nieto, the Mexican president, was asked directly, what do you think about immigration reform? And basically what he said, to paraphrase, is, we think it's very important and we wish President Obama well in the work he's doing. So we're not going to comment on, we're not going to say what Mexico wants, but definitely signaling that it's an important issue for Mexico, but seeing it very much as a domestic policy issue and political issue here in the United States.
And we're almost up in a break here, Cindy, but I'm wondering, with an improving Mexican economy, whether that is keeping some people in that country.
Undoubtedly, it is. Growth in Mexico is robust, certainly even in comparison to the United States. There are fewer Mexicans coming. There are people going back to Mexico from the United States, where you don't see much of a decline. In fact, you see an increase, and I think potentially very worrisome is the traffic and the flows of Central American migrants, you know, through Mexico on the way to the United States. And as the economies in Central America remain depressed for the most part, as crime and violence continues to be such a significant problem, the drivers of migration will continue. And making it more difficult for people to come in is only going to, I think, increase the violence, increase the role of organized crime in the trafficking of migrants.
Well, we're talking about Mexico, Colombia, Brazil, Venezuela, talking about Latin America today in Radio Times with Cynthia Arnson and Shannon O'Neill, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Hamilton Public Media Commons Young Journalist Summer Camp is back at WHYY. Students in grades 9 through 12 will create video news stories and learn from award-winning journalists and media professionals, interviewing, shooting and editing video, and more. Two-week sessions starting August 5th. RSVP at whyy.org/camps. And young movie makers can submit entries for WHYY's Youth Media Awards now. Visit whyy.org/awards to learn more.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Gilbert about his new novel, Anne Sons. At the center of the story is a reclusive novelist who, like Salinger, has a special place in the hearts of readers, especially those who read him when they were young. But the writer's sons don't feel that connection. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Detroit says we're bankrupt, and the message to thousands of possible pension holders is, never mind.
You made a promise. You know, you just can't say, forget about that.
The promise and paradox of pensions in 21st century America facing a new economic reality. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are getting an update on Latin America Day with our guest, Cynthia Arnson, director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Shannon O'Neill, the senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about Cuba, but first let me get Dan. It looks like Dan from South Philadelphia first joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome.
I have a question. There's a continuing narrative in this discussion about the rule of law. And one of the things that we often hear about, at least in the Middle East conflict, is that unless there is a culture that respects the rule of law, it's very difficult to not have it undermined. And in Latin America and Central America, where you have such tremendous social disparity, even in the economies that are, we see as prospering right now, how does that disparity undermine the ability to actually implement and support a rule and a culture of law that keeps people from getting into these illegal activities to kind of make up for the shortfall? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Dan, thanks for the call to Radio Time. Shannon, do you want to take that first?
Sure, I agree. Thanks, Dan, for your question. And I do agree that many of the disparities in wealth and particularly access to opportunities, whether it's schooling or healthcare or jobs and the like, it does make a big difference. But I'm always reminded, I've spent some time down on the border when I was researching and writing my book, and you look at two cities such as El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, and you can it's hard to find something so different so close. So, you know, Ciudad Juarez, up until a few years ago, had the unfortunate distinction not only of being the most violent city in Mexico, but by many accounts, the most violent city in the world. And right across the border, you could barely see the line in many places, is El Paso, Texas, which is one of the safest cities of its size, and even in absolute numbers, in the United States. And you also have here almost the exact same population and sort of its origins, its Mexican origins and the like. Almost 85-90% of people who live in El Paso are Mexican-American origin, and you have the same on the other side. But you have such different outcomes. And to me, this says it's not about the people, it's not about a culture as the sense, but it's really about institutional incentives, i.e. it's really about the rules. Do people follow the rules, and are there consequences if you don't follow the rules? And unfortunately, in places like Ciudad Juarez, for many, many years now, there's no consequences if you break the law, because they don't have police forces that work. They don't have court systems that work. And you add to this, as Dan was saying, these disparities, which are more significant in Juarez than in El Paso. But I really do think that one of these main factors to think about for Mexico or Latin America more broadly is how do you make these systems work so people start believing in that? Because that can change the incentive structure, change what we usually think about as culture.
Let me get, looks like John from Havertown to join us. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I had heard that the United States had given Brazil approximately $12 billion for offshore oil exploration. And I know they're self-sufficient with their energy needs. Couldn't that money be redirected towards their infrastructure?
Cynthia, you want to take that?
Sure. I'm not sure what the caller means about the United States giving. I mean, I think that there have been a number of private companies that have been very interested in the offshore oil deposits, which are huge reserves of potential, you know, huge significance both for Brazil and for the companies that have been involved with Petrobras, the state oil company. I think there is an issue here about how money is spent, government money, development money, infrastructure money, to improve the road system, not just for companies that are trying to get products to market and to port, but that really support, you know, the way people need to move around in Brazil and support greater connectivity between cities and to service the internal market. Brazil's development bank, the state development bank, is a huge player in this, not only in Brazil but throughout the region. There is a massive need, not just in a country as big as Brazil, but really throughout the region, to improve infrastructure and connectivity.
Let me see what Joseph from Morgantown has to say. Joseph, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I run a helicopter company that did some work for the Honduran Air Force, and have had the really pleasure to visit Tegucigalpa twice over the past 3 years. And I guess I was sort of surprised some time ago to learn that it's supposed to be one of the most violent cities in the world. And then reference was made earlier in this program about the triangle of violence with Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. Granted, my experience may not have been the sort of typical tourist experience there. We had sort of privileged access with the Honduran Air Force, but there was real interest in job creation related to the work that we were doing. We were training, members of the Honduran Air Force on technical skills. And, I just found it very heartening and a good counterpoint to some of the more negative stories that you hear about both interest and attention from, American citizens and companies, as well as what I think is, kind of a good opportunity to partner for economic development in the region.
Well, Joseph, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. An interesting kind of disconnect there. I'm not sure who I should toss this to. Cynthia, can I toss that back to you?
Sure. There's obviously a need for lots of economic investment to create opportunities, precisely as this particular company is doing. But there's also, I think, a strong sense that until the security climate improves in major cities like Tegucigalpa and San Pedro Sula, it's going to be very, very difficult for investors to come when they have to basically live a very, very sequestered life, not be able to go out, travel in armored cars with bodyguards, have their children travel, with bodyguards. The security crisis is a real disincentive to the kind of development and investment that would take place from abroad and that is so needed and so desired, on the part of these countries.
Joseph, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me ask you about, it's such a curious development. A ship from Cuba en route to North Korea was stopped in Panama and looking through bags of, underneath bags of sugar, they found Soviet-age weapons, on their way to North Korea. The explanation being they were on their way to be fixed there or perhaps updated. Shannon O'Neill, what do you make of what happened in Panama?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what was going on there, and they were sending these old weapons, it looks like, to North Korea. And hiding them under sugar makes it a bit more suspect as well, really, that they weren't doing something, under the cover. But I would say we have to frame this in the larger U.S.-Cuban relationship. And obviously there have been longstanding tensions because of the embargo, what they call the blockade. There's other issues there that have been quite difficult between the bilateral relationship, but also in the larger U.S.-Latin America relationship. This has been a sticking point repeatedly at international meetings, at multilateral organizations, why we still have this very strong embargo versus Cuba when we've ended this type of relationship with places like Vietnam or others that had similar systems. But I would say that what we are seeing today with Cuba and have over the last several years is a beginning to open up a bit. Baby steps on both sides, but a beginning to open up in the relationship. So whether it's allowing more visits of Cuban Americans back to families, whether it's allowing more back and forth in terms of money to these families, there's been talk now about opening up direct mail services between the countries so mail can go back and forth, which has been stopped for years and years. I do think, and there's some not-so-secret support within the overall Obama government for even going further in opening up these relationships. You've heard different officials talk a bit about it. It hasn't happened yet, but there's been talk about it. So I would put this, as well as other tensions within the relationship, in this overall trend that shows it the relationship warming rather than cooling. But this could be problematic as people get to the bottom of it in terms of what was actually going on.
But you think, Cindy, it's time to either end the embargo or take more than the baby steps that Shannon just described between U.S. And Cuba?
Well, ending the embargo is really, at this point, a question of U.S. law. And I would agree that the Obama administration has done as much as it could as an executive branch, as the White House, to improve the relationship, to create greater openness, to create greater access for people living in Cuba to travel opportunities in the United States, for families to go back, to send remittances, to visit. The increase in people-to-people contact is actually, I think, quite significant. Mm. And there have been small openings, economic openings, the very tentative beginnings of, I hesitate to call it a private sector, but of private entrepreneurs, of individuals who are allowed to, you know, create their own businesses. And these are very important changes. And there had been migration talks. And so, you know, you look at this incident around the Korean ship that was stopped in Panama, and you just kind of wonder, like, what were they thinking? I mean, the fact that it was so hidden, as Shannon mentioned, is, you know, raises all sorts of questions. And I believe that this is going to be, you know, referred to the appropriate UN agencies to look into whether or not this constituted a violation of the existing sanctions against North Korea.
Well, and I'm looking at the clock here. A couple of other issues I do want to talk about, and including the fact that Pope Francis, he's in Brazil now. He's in country for the Catholic Youth Fest, and of course, he has Latin American roots. Is that significant, Shannon?
I think it is significant that he is there, and this is the big gathering of young people in the Catholic tradition. And what's interesting, we talked a bit about culture before with one of your callers. This is a big issue. We've seen in Latin America for many, many years, centuries, Catholicism being a base of much of the culture. But what you're seeing in Latin America broadly, and in Brazil in particular, is coming to the forefront because of this visit, is a movement away from that. You've seen the rise of other Protestant religions, of evangelicals, of Pentecostals, of other types of churches rise. And you've also seen, as you've seen in many places around the world, but in many Latin American countries, while people see themselves as perhaps culturally Catholic or nominally Catholic, when you ask them how often they get to church, it's much less than that, right? It's only at the big holidays, if at all. And so that shift in Latin America that's been happening is obviously important and worrisome for this Pope and the overall Catholic structure or institution, but it's also part of the changes that are happening in society more broadly.
What do you see, Cindy?
Well, I see a very, very different Pope going to Brazil. This is someone who has done away with all of the sort of trappings of wealth and status and stature that very much lives a simple life, that has identified with common people, that takes up their struggles, takes them to heart. You have to remember, too, that the Catholic Church went through huge changes in the 1960s and 70s with the embrace of what was known as liberation theology. And there was a huge counter-reaction against that, and this is not, you know, a return to those years, but it's a very, very different kind of church that's paying attention to the grassroots, that's paying attention to the significant challenge that's posed not only by secularism, but by Protestant evangelical churches, by the number of people who used to be active participating Catholics. The numbers have gone down something like 30% since the early 1970s. So it's a church that has lost a lot of its following and is looking to reconnect with a younger generation and on a host of issues that really resonate with everyday people. And I think that that's a very, very significant change. And the fact that an Argentine pope takes his first overseas trip to neighboring Brazil at this particular moment in terms of the protests, I think is very, very significant.
And I have one more question for you, and we're almost out of time. And I apologize for doing this at the end of the show. To you, Shannon, what are some interesting developments out of those National Security Agency document leaks affiliated or associated with Edward Snowden is that the U.S. surveillance in Central and South America, that has come to light. Is that going to be a problem for the United States?
You know, we've seen the different diplomatic corps in the various countries, those especially that this has been uncovered. They've seen them express publicly and diplomatically their worry and also their the fact that they're upset that the United States, it seems for all intents and purposes, has been spying on them.
Right.
But you look at U.S. relations with all of these countries, and many of them more than others, but you look at the relations with these countries, and they're much deeper and much more complex than just this issue. And so while you've seen, you know, direct frustration, I don't see it derailing relationships with many of these countries, and particularly the countries that with which we work very closely, whether it's Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, many of the Central American nations and the like. I don't see it changing the overall relationship between these countries because they really are so deep and so complex.
You have 30 seconds, Cindy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that there are a number of core interests that will keep those many relationships on track, but we shouldn't underestimate the damage that has been done. This is an Obama administration that from the outset has claimed to do things differently, to see the region differently, to want a different kind of partnership with the region, and then it turns out, you know, that we're scooping up all sorts of not only private conversations, but commercial conversations, and that's I think deeply troubling, including in representative democracies that have made the transition from dictatorship, where all these issues of spying and surveillance have a very bad past.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Cynthia Arnson, thank you so much.
Marty, thank you. A pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And Shannon O'Neill, thank you very much as well.
It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. And I learned a lot as well. Shannon O'Neill, Senior Fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Cynthia Arnson, Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to learn more about this program. Emily Bryant produced this hour of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.